Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to understand who is working against our interests, to understand how and why they're doing so. Because exposing such schemes isn't condemning, it isn't inappropriate, it isn't hateful, it's the most caring thing we can do. And in that regard, one of the most courageous and caring men I have ever come to know is IQ Al Rasooli. He is with us this morning, and without preparation, the two of us, I have not told IQ what I wish to talk about today, we're going to speak from the heart. And we're going to speak from the heart about what caused 9/11. Yesterday, people all over the world celebrated the opening of the 9/11 Museum. And so I thought maybe if we spent this time telling our listeners what caused 9/11, who was behind the suicide bombings, why did they do it, and is there a way to stop whoever planned it, perpetrated it, and celebrated those suicide bombings that left 3,000 innocent people dead from continuing to use terrorist attacks to maim and murder others? IQ, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm glad that you didn't tell me.
Yes. There's a difference between preparing and speaking from the heart. When you speak from the heart, the only way that you can do it and do so credibly is to have used your eyes to be observant, usually to read information that's available to us so that you can learn. And then using your conscience, that unique human attribute that gives us the ability to exercise good judgment, to make connections between the various things you learn so that you can form conclusions that lead to understanding. And when you've done that and you've invested the time and you come to know what is happening and understand how and why it is happening, then you actually incorporate it into the very fabric of your being. It provides perspective, understanding, and it provides the courage and characters often to stand up and do what you're doing. So I'd like to speak from the heart about what caused 9/11. IQ, can we begin with a little bit of history? Because the cause of 9/11 began in a backward place of the world, that little town called Mecca in 610 of the Common Era. Let's just put that in perspective, if we might. Egypt, which began circa 2000 BCE, is there any indication that Egyptians influenced the Arabian Peninsula, or they just go around it as the Tigris and Euphrates rivers sort of circumnavigate Arabia?
No, the Egyptians had absolutely no idea that Arabia or influenced Arabia. They knew Arabia existed, obviously.
Right.
They had the Sinai between them. But
right.
Otherwise, no. In fact, Okay. Nobody influenced Arabia in any way, shape, or form, which was negative.
Right, which is kind of interesting. Assyria is the next major civilization in the Middle East. I've read Assyrian history. And they fought and controlled the areas around Mesopotamia and then followed the Tigris and Euphrates rivers up through Syria and into Israel and even into battles with Egypt. But there is no indication the Assyrians ever engaged or had a reason to go into the deserts of the Arabian Peninsula.
Because you called it a desert. It's absolutely a desert. They have
nothing
no rivers.
There. Yeah, nothing.
I don't
there.
Know if our listeners know. No one can name a single river in the whole of 900,000 square miles of Saudi Arabia or the Arabian Peninsula.
Correct.
Not now, a single river.
It's circa about 600 BCE, the Babylonians deposed the Assyrians. Is there any indication that the Babylonians, which were a very literate civilization, is there any indication the Babylonians interacted with the Arabs in the Arabian Peninsula?
Not in the south, but definitely on the very extreme north.
Yeah, along where
Babylonians had a small town.
Yeah, along particularly along where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers would border the north part of Arabian Peninsula. Yeah, places like Haran, for example. Yeah, Haran would be an example. But the birthplace of Islam, of the cause of 9/11, is way south of that. So then we deal with the conquest of Alexander the Great, the great Greek conqueror, if you want to call him great. He certainly was a good warrior. When he led his troops through Turkey, today's Turkey, he was fighting the Persians, correct?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, and that's who he initially battled. And in his battles against the Persians, did they fight any battles in Arabia, or did he go around the Arabian Desert?
Well, he went to the north of Arabia. Everybody goes to the north of the Arabian Desert. Very few people ever attempted to conquer it because there was nothing there to conquer.
Correct.
There was nothing there.
So the nothing there to conquer?
This was oil, and that was found by the Europeans.
Yeah, in the 1930s.
Yeah.
So no interaction between Alexander the Great and the Arabian of the Arabian Desert. You then have the rise of Rome. The Greek Empire is established right around 300 BCE. You have the rise of Rome. I've studied every single Roman battle. I can't see a single Roman battle being fought for anything in the Arabian Peninsula. They went above it.
But they sent, I think, one division of 10,000 who perished in the north of Arabian Peninsula in a sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I studied.
Yes, and that was actually the only reason for that is they were looking for a faster way to attack the Persians than the typical route of following along the Tigris and Euphrates River. They wanted a more direct route, and they perished on the way, and they never went there again. Now Rome fell. Sacked in the 4th century and in the 5th century CE. Rome was, the Grand Empire of Rome was actually gone before Islam is manifest in 610 BCE.
Correct.
Now, the town that Islam had its beginnings is called Mecca, correct?
Correct.
Now, was there any industry in Mecca?
None.
Was there any agriculture in Mecca?
Very little. I mean, very little. Just to sustain the population, the small population.
Yeah. Was there any building in Mecca that would be anything other than either a pile of rocks, the Kaaba, or adobe, which is essentially clay sightings of buildings? Was there anything other than mud huts and rock piles?
Well, nobody can find, and nobody has ever found, any monument in the whole of the Arabian Peninsula north of the Yemen. None.
Yeah.
No structure. No documents. No engravings. Absolutely dead.
Okay, so in this oasis of civilization, was there a written alphabet? Was there a means to convey information in writing?
Not a dot.
Not a dot, was there? Matter of fact, written Arabic wouldn't exist for almost 100 years later, and written Arabic was actually created in Syria by modifying Hebrew.
Yes, but it was created by the Christians.
Yeah, it was created by Christian Syriacs.
It's called Syriac.
Yeah, it's called Syriac. It was created by, but at the time, a disproportionate number of those who were the followers of the way, who knew Yahusha, were Jews, and the message they wanted to convey was in the Torah. It was written in Hebrew, and they created an alphabet for the Arabians that is almost identical to Hebrew. All right, so that's the timing of all of this. That's the oasis of civilization from which it emerged. At the time, the people of Mecca, they had to have something to sustain them. What was it that made?
Trade.
Yeah,
trade.
Okay. So that's right. They were traders. Now, at the time, we're dealing now with the 7th century CE at 610. Wasn't most trade by ship at that time?
Not from Arabia.
Well, not from the Central Arabia. But if for example, if the Persians wanted to ship something from Babylon and they wanted to ship it to Egypt, they're going to ship it as far as they can via water before they even attempt to go over land. Correct?
Correct.
All right. And when the Romans and the Greeks were engaged in trading, it was all shipborne.
Okay.
Yep. So, but in Arabia, no, that wasn't the case. It was camels, right?
Camels and donkeys, yes.
Okay. And so it was in this community that a fellow named Muhammad was born. What was Muhammad out doing when he first claimed to have heard the initial recital, because he calls it a Quran, which, by the way, is a Hebrew word, not an Arab word. It's from the Hebrew kara, which means to read and recite. When he got his first recital,
so-called revelation.
Yes, from his spirit friend. What was he out doing?
He got the shock of his life. He was scared. He nearly committed suicide. He thought he was possessed by the devil, Satan.
Correct. And at the time, wasn't he out celebrating the kind of the pagan rites of that community? They had their feast days and their fast days and their days to go off and pay homage to the various rock gods. Wasn't he just out being religious?
Of course. Nothing has changed in pagan Arabian Islam religion. Nothing was changed.
So the spirit that he met scared him to death. Is that correct? I mean, he said that the spirit was wrestled with him, pushed him almost to the point of death. I mean, pretty nasty spirit, right? And the spirit that he was molesting him asked him to read, and he was illiterate. So the spirit wasn't very smart either. We'll pick this up after the commercial break. The Shattering Miss Revenue conversation with IQ Al Rasuli about what it was that caused 9/11. And so we have to turn our attention to Mecca. This would be in 610 CE. So in this cave, IQ, Muhammad claims that the spirit was especially violent. Rather than trying to enhance his life, it tried to snuff out his life. And the spirit was not only violent, nearly killing him, but the spirit wasn't the brightest spirit in the world. It asked a illiterate man to read, not once, but three times. Is that all accurate?
It is accurate, because he said, "Iqra bismi rabbika." Iqra means to read. And if he were actually the messenger of Allah, and if Allah were God, Allah should have known that Muhammad was supposed to be illiterate, so he couldn't read.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, almost everyone in Mecca was illiterate because there wasn't a written language for them to read. Now,
correct.
Going one step further about the intelligence level of this particular spirit that Muhammad claims to have met with in this cave, you'll find a revelation in the 96th surah of the Quran. And what did the spirit tell Muhammad that was, well, I want to use the word stupid.
Well, he told him, "Iqra bismi rabbika, الذي خلق خلق الإنسان من علق," means the God who created man from a leech. Or
okay.
Mankind from a leech. Well, it can't be more stupid than that.
from a leech. So and some people will say that it really was from a coagulated drop of blood. In other words, a scab. Some say a scab, some say a leech. Are there various ways to interpret the item from which humankind was conceived according to the spirit?
No, only two ways, and both of them are wrong.
Okay. So, scab, coagulated blood, scab, or leech would be the two ways it can be interpreted, and both are absolutely wrong.
Yes, but they're not interpreted. That's exactly what the Arabs, you know, say they mean. So it's not a matter of interpretation. This is what they mean.
Okay. So, the initial revelation is mean-spirited, it's violent, it's focused on death as opposed to life. It's in a cave with a man that is, a pagan. It asks a man who, is illiterate to read, and then it makes a, pronunciation that man was created in a way that is absolutely erroneous and foolish. That's the start.
It's illogical. I mean, of course, as you said, the scab, or blood clot, they call it, is dead. So how could you create from a dead?
That's right. No, moreover, you know, we are not conceived from dead blood. All right. So that's the start of Islam. And anyone that wants to verify what we're saying can read the hadith and they can read the Quran opening it at the 96er. All that's correct. Then what was Muhammad's reaction to this horrific experience?
He was horrified. He was so horrified, he ran all the way to his wife, telling her in shock to be covering him, to protect him. And he told her that he had thoughts of committing suicide because he thought he was possessed by the jinn. The jinn, of course, were the equivalent of the devils in pagan Arabia.
Okay, so he claims to have been demon-possessed, claims to have contemplated suicide. So this was really, this is a really pretty, if this is supposed to be God, this is one horrific God. This is a deity you would not want to meet.
I agree. Nasty. Extremely nasty.
And stupid.
And stupid.
Yeah, nasty and stupid. And this is the first indication we have of the nature of the spirit that Muhammad would claim to be Allah.
Correct.
Now, this whole episode should have died right there. The world would have been better off if Muhammad had committed suicide. Muhammad's wife, who was really his benefactor, she was almost twice his age. She didn't like the idea of her boy toy embarrassing himself through all of this. She had a different response, didn't she?
Correct, but we've got to tell the people listening that she was not a pagan woman. She was either a Christian or influenced by Christianity because her uncle, Waraka bin Nawfal, was a Christian. So she's not an illiterate, stupid woman like Muhammad. She was a very clever woman, very successful merchant, and one of the richest women in Mecca.
Yeah. We don't know if she was a Christian. What we know is that there is a relative who claims to be a Christian, but she certainly wasn't as illiterate, as dumb, as lazy, or imaginative, probably even, as her husband. Welcome back to Shattering Mystery. Having a conversation with IQ Al-Rasuli about who perpetrated 9/11 and where the motivation for 9/11 was born. The thing that we know for absolute certain about Muhammad's horrible encounter with the dark spirit in the cave, the stupid and violent, mean spirit in the cave, is that when he came back to his wife, his wife was a businesswoman. And so she came up with a business proposition to salvage her reputation in the little mud hut town of Mecca. What did she tell Muhammad?
She told him that his Allah would never desert him, that his Allah, that he is a messenger of Allah, that he shouldn't say that he was possessed by the demons, that he was actually divinely inspired.
So her proposition was the creator god of the universe, which was a black stone there in the Kaaba, which was a pile of stones, told her guy that man was created from coagulated blood, and that God is a really violent, demented spirit that likes to molest people.
Correct.
We're going to go with that. All right. But she did. The fact of the matter is. Okay, so Muhammad began then to claim that he was having these revelations everywhere. I mean, after that one, they came fast and furious. And weren't most of Muhammad's revelations following this initial one, weren't most of the revelations just argumentative, where Muhammad's alleged God is telling the Meccans, who are about the least meaningful people on the planet, that the Meccans are mean and they're tormenting and harassing poor little Muhammad, and therefore this dark spirit is going to torture these Meccans in hell for the rest of eternity. Isn't that basically what the next 30 or 40 or 50 revelations say?
Yes. In fact, all these revelations concern Muhammad and Muhammad only. His relationship with his own tribe who rejected him.
Right. I mean, that's really it. I mean, it's so for the next 30 or 40 revelations from this spiritual entity, all we really have is an argument between meaningless individuals, between an oasis of civilization in the mud hut town of Mecca, and this lowlife named Muhammad, and the arguments they're childish, aren't they?
Very, very childish, very stupid, but really they are a reflection of Muhammad's thoughts.
Of course.
The Quran is Muhammad. He invented it completely.
Of course. So what we have here is that Muhammad makes the claim that he is Allah's messenger. He actually didn't like using Allah initially. He used Ar-Rahman, which was a Yemenite deity, because Ar-Rahman was far enough away, and there was already some religious literature that he could plagiarize for Ar-Rahman. So he used Ar-Rahman initially as his god's name. And when he would claim to be the messenger of Ar-Rahman, his tribe, his neighbors, just mocked him. They said, "Oh, come on. This is all a ruse. You're doing it for financial gain. You're making all this up. You really are demon-possessed. You are insane. You're an absolute waste of time. Go away." And all of that's recorded, by the way, in the Quran, of them saying that. Those who knew Muhammad best, that was their view of him. And then Muhammad has his wannabe God, his dark spirit, his alter persona, say, "Oh yeah, no, I'm not. I'm not insane. I'm not demon possessed. I'm not an idiot. And my God's going to get you for saying that." Don't we have like 30 or 40 consecutive revelations that's basically all they say?
Could go more than 30 or 40. There are 6,236 verses in the Quran. Most of them, except especially the ones in Mecca, were exactly that. A dialogue between Muhammad and his tribe, him threatening them with death and destruction at the hands of his God, Allah, and them saying, "You are a charlatan, you are a liar."
Yeah. So those who knew Muhammad best called him a charlatan and a liar. I know when I took the time to put the Quran in chronological order and to use the hadith, the oral reports from Muhammad and the first Muslims, by the time you've gone through these 40, 50, 60 surahs, I mean, you're just wrung out. You're saying, "Oh, good God, already? I mean, give it up." This sounds like it's a mud-flinging fight amongst five-year-old brats. It's unbelievably childish. And if you were to attribute that to God, your God would have to be
an
imbecile.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
Imbecile.
Yeah.
Now, that's what the Quran is all about.
The threats made by this wannabe God against the Muhammad's neighbors that were taunting him by declaring what he really was, don't they depict this God always in hell?
Absolutely, always in hell. He's always watching in hell.
Yeah.
Watching the people he created. This
from hell.
Created humanity, according to
right.
Muhammad.
Right, from hell.
And he's watching them in hell. 80% of humanity are destined to go to hell.
Okay, and not only are they destined to go to hell, isn't Muhammad busy in hell? Doesn't he? Doesn't the Quran depict what Muhammad is doing to the inhabitants of hell?
Well, not personally, but I mean, he's watching.
No. That's I beg to differ with you. There must be 20 places in those early surahs where Muhammad describes what Allah is doing in hell. He's ripping people's skins off. He's pouring
He went on his trip, you remember?
Uh-huh.
In 622 A.D., he had this mythical trip to the seven heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he went to hell.
Yeah, on the way. And so Muhammad is providing lurid depictions of what Allah is doing in hell. Allah is essentially depicted as as sadistic, as one who spends his time torturing.
In fact, more sadistic than the Nazis, literally.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so that's where we get to the point then where we have this never-ending argument, and finally it appears that the Meccans said, all right, you're making a nuisance of yourself. I'll tell you what, we'll give you some pretty girls, we'll give you some money, we'll make you king for a day. All you need to do is incorporate our goddesses into your religion, because that would be good for business. That's how the Kaaba makes its money. Which, if you'll do that for us, then we'll give you these things that you want. What was Muhammad's response to the offer?
He did.
He accepted it, didn't he?
He actually did, because the satanic verses prove that he allowed for the daughters of Allah to be intercessors mm-hmm. between Allah and the humanity.
Mm-hmm. So that made...
He changed his mind.
Yeah, that makes made for four or five gods and goddesses in what was supposed to be a monotheistic religion. And so it was Abu Bakr that complained. And Abu Bakr at that point was heavily invested in Muhammad, correct?
Correct.
Because he had given Muhammad his 6-year-old daughter to be a sexual plaything. So at this point, doesn't Muhammad admit that all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan?
Almost, yes.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. And then when he's really now being mocked and harassed for by the Meccans, that's when he has this imaginary trip to Jerusalem, correct?
Correct.
And
well, he didn't, by the way. It's only in the Hadith, not in the Quran.
That he made the names. Yeah, Jerusalem is not mentioned, although the trip is mentioned in the Quran. It just doesn't designate where the trip was to in the Quran.
Mentioned.
Right.
And it doesn't tell you where it went.
Yes. The Hadith says that it was to Jerusalem. In the Quran.
Hadith,
right. In the Quran, Muhammad didn't even know the name of the town, so he didn't mention it. But he claims that while he was there, he met with all of the big shots of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in the temple. When was the temple destroyed?
In 570 A.D.
No, the temple was destroyed.
In
175. Actually, it was destroyed in 70 C.E. And then Jerusalem itself was destroyed in 135. So, the temple was destroyed in 70. You are correct on the 135 date. That's when Jerusalem was destroyed. So there was no Jerusalem to go to, and there was no temple to visit. And oh, by the way, at that time, it was illegal for a Jew to be in the city of Jerusalem, so you couldn't have met with the prophetic big shots of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
All of it is wrong.
Of course.
If there was no temple, how could he claim
and
that
no city,
he prayed
and no city.
Solomon? That's what I want to know.
It's impossible. Okay, so he's just continuing to lie, and the lies get bigger and bigger. And as the lies became gargantuan, and they are gargantuan at this point, he admits that he spoke on behalf of Satan. He's contradicting himself. The never-ending argument is getting wearisome. The Meccans are saying, you know, if you're speaking for God, why don't you do a miracle? You know, why don't you have the black stone of the Kaaba roll over? I mean, do something. And if he says, I can't do anything. In fact, he constantly says, I can't perform a miracle.
Absolutely. And, the Quran and, says so.
Yep. And then, so he just becomes a laughingstock. And he was laughed out of Mecca in shame. Correct?
Correct.
And so he heads to a town that most people have never heard of. It's called Yathrib.
That's the Arab name.
Yeah, Yathrib. And at the time that he's headed to Yathrib, he encounters, and it was a mixed town. There were three of the four tribes there, whether they were Jewish racially or Arab racially. They religiously, they were Jewish.
They were Judaized Arab, no question
okay.
about it.
Yeah, okay. And, but on the way there, Muhammad meets with the pagan Arabs.
Correct.
Okay. And it's called the Pledge of Aqaba. And Muhammad's really, really upset at this point. He's been laughed out of Mecca as an absolute nincompoop. And he's really angry. And so this Pledge of Aqaba, what was the Pledge of Aqaba all about?
Very simple. He told the pagan Arabs, the two tribes who lived among the Jews or the Judaized Arabs,
mm-hmm.
and who knew that the Jews or Judaized Arabs were expecting the coming of the Messiah,
mm-hmm.
he told them that he is the Messiah of the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they followed every single item of his instruction,
mm-hmm.
in death they will end up in heaven,
mm-hmm.
paradise. In life they take all the plunder and booty from the people he directs them to destroy.
In fact, the Pledge of Aqaba is actually that these Arabs said, we will wage war against all humankind on behalf of Muhammad. Is that true?
It was a win-win situation for them.
We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're going over the history of the perpetrator of 9/11 so that our listeners might know who planned and executed 9/11 and why they did so. So we're at the Pledge of Aqaba. Muhammad has just been pushed out of Mecca in shame. He's become a laughingstock for his satanic verses, for his imaginary wild-ass ride to the non-existent city and temple, and then for all manner of things. And so he finds a group of guys that he's convinced to fight for him. Now, once that happens, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Pledge of Aqaba, once that happens, the Quran, which has been this never-ending argument between Muhammad and his neighbors, changes, doesn't it?
It changes completely. It becomes a fighting machine.
Right. As a matter of fact, at that point forward, the only message is fight and kill.
Absolute. Slaughter, slaughter, slaughter. Plunder, slaughter, and enslave. Plunder, slaughter, and enslave.
And the first surah revealed about justifying this was, you find it in the second surah. You and I talked about that a week ago, where in the second surah, Muhammad says that the harassment that he received in Mecca is far worse than slaughter. So that he told his Muslim pals that they ought to go slaughter anyone that besmirched them. That said, if you said something that they didn't like, then they were ordered at that point to go fight and kill everyone who didn't surrender to this new religion.
Correct.
And that's in the second surah.
Then, of course.
Right. And then in the eighth surah, Muhammad has now demonstrated his new religion in practice. Can you tell us what the basis was of the eighth surah and how the religion of Islam now took shape?
The anfal means the plunder. So he justified to his followers why mm-hmm. they are entitled to plunder anybody who is not follower of Muhammad. That's 90% or 80% of humanity.
Okay, so in this, in the particular circumstances regarding this, is Muhammad was broke. The first Muslims didn't work. And so they became pirates, and they chose to raid a civilian caravan. raid a bunch of business guys, and they plunder them. Now, tell us a little bit about this. It's called the Battle of Badr. Now, it couldn't have been a battle because their target was a group of business guys, of traders. I mean, they were all civilians. There was no army. There was no military.
Yeah.
So it was an ambush. Okay.
And the ambush was to plunder and to slaughter the enemies of Muhammad, or the perceived enemies of Muhammad. And he did a good job there. Slaughter, plunder. He mutilated and he tortured the people he captured. And from then on, this has been the methodology for the last 1,400 years of all the followers of Muhammad. And we see them on television 24 hours a day in 57 Muslim states and outside the Muslim states every day. Nothing has changed.
So the first tangible demonstration of Islam is in the first year of the Islamic era. And Muhammad is leading a terrorist raid against a civilian caravan for the purpose of stealing their possessions. And in the process, he is murderous. He is sadistic, torturing individuals. He gloats about the whole thing. He even kidnaps individuals and ransoms them. I mean, if this is godly, I vote for a different God. What do you think?
I agree, but he's not godly. We have said that a million times. Allah is most definitely, most assuredly not the same as the God of Jesus, Moses, and Abraham. Full stop. Is there anybody listening who can argue with us? The answer is no.
Of course not. Of course not. Allah is actually the antithesis.
Can come against you and me.
No. In fact, Allah is the antithesis of Yahweh. While Muhammad is the caricature upon which the character upon which Allah is fleshed out, and that Allah is essentially Muhammad's alter ego.
But
the fact is that
Satan and Gabriel are one and the same. Anybody who reads the Quran will come to the exactly the same conclusion, except if they are followers of Muhammad. Why?
Yeah.
Because no follower of Muhammad can possibly have two brain cells of logic. If they have two brain cells of logic, they would not be followers of Muhammad. That simple.
Yeah.
It is not complicated.
It is that simple. They were one and the same. And we'll return with IQ Al-Rasuli for one segment after the news and commercial break.